Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Welcome to DW's Africa Link program, live from our studios in Bonn, Germany. I am Zipporah Nyambura.
And I'm Jane Ayeka-Kumet in Bonn, Germany. On today's program,
Kenya bans protests in major towns as tension builds up ahead of repeat presidential elections.
For the time being, we will not allow demonstrations within the central business districts of Nairobi, Mombasa, and Kisumu.
And keeping their fingers crossed, Palestinians hopeful as the two faction groups sign an agreement.
Our hope is to bring the country together. That is what every Palestinian wants.
We'll bring you these stories and a lot more from our social media platforms.
But first, let's hear what's been happening around the world.
My name is Jen Nyinge with DW News. We begin in Kenya, where with exactly 2 weeks before a fresh presidential election, the government has banned protests in central business districts of three major cities, the capital Nairobi, Mombasa, and opposition's stronghold of Kisumu. Interior Minister Fred Matiang'i said this is due to more cases of looting and damage to public property. Opposition supporters have been holding regular protests demanding changes on the electoral body before October 26th poll.
In the recent past, we have noted with great concern the escalation of lawlessness, breach of peace and public order during demonstrations organized by NASA, serious disruption of normal business activities, occasioning massive economic losses.
Moving on, the U.S. has pulled out of UNESCO after the Palestinian Authority was accepted to the UN agency as a full member. The overwhelming backing of the Palestinian bid to join UNESCO is a huge boost to their campaign for international recognition of an independent state and a major blow to Israel and the U.S., who had opposed the move. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Authority will take full control of Gaza Strip by 1st of December, following a historic agreement between rival groups Hamas and Fatah. The two Palestinian groups have been at odds since they fought a near civil war in 2007. Several reconciliation attempts have failed, but the recent Egyptian-headed push received a major boost when Hamas agreed to cede civilian power in Gaza. You are listening to DW, Germany's international broadcaster. At least 8 people have been killed and 30 wounded in renewed clashes in Ethiopia Oromia region. Anti-government protests are reported to have taken place in a number of towns. Last year, hundreds were killed during widespread protests in the Oromia and Amhara regions. The government imposed a state of emergency, which was lifted in August. Britain Prime Minister Theresa May claims good progress in the latest Brexit talks, despite European Union chief negotiator Michel Barnier disclosing that they have hit a dead end and ruled out discussions on future trade partnerships. EU leaders are due to meet in Brussels on October 19th and 20th, and with very limited time to seal a deal, it has been hoped they would agree to widen the talks.
And Michel Barnier himself has recognised that over the coming weeks we will be able to make constructive progress. There has been a lot of work put into this. There are many issues on which we're very close to agreement, such as on citizens' rights, for example. But we also want to ensure that we get onto that business of talking about the future relationship, the future partnership we're going to have with the EU.
One of the presidential candidates in the just-concluded Liberia general elections has demanded for a halt in announcing the results, citing irregularities in the vote. Charles Bramskine, who was running on Liberty Party, has threatened to take legal action if the National Elections Commission did not act on his demands. Bramskine was considered a frontrunner to take over from President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. For more news and information, visit our website, dw.com. My name is Jane Nyinge.
You're listening to DW's Africa Link, coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany. I'm Jane Ayeko-Kumet.
And I am Zipporah Nyambura, and we start off in Kenya again, where the Kenyan government has banned opposition protests in the country's three biggest cities of Mombasa, Kisumu, and the capital Nairobi. The opposition led by Raila Odinga has been holding bi-weekly protests demanding reforms at Kenya's electoral body IEBC before the repeat presidential elections on the 26th of this month. But the opposition has now announced the protests will be held daily from Monday. DW's Andrew Wasike brings us more on this and how the protests have affected the country's economy.
Scenes like this could become a daily occurrence if Kenya's main opposition, NASA, goes ahead with its plan to hold daily protests against the Electoral Commission. But the Kenyan government has swiftly moved in by banning the demonstrations, citing looting and vandalism, as Interior Cabinet Secretary Fred Matiang'i states.
We have noted with great concern the escalation of lawlessness, breach of peace and public order during demonstrations organized by NASA and festered in Kisumu, Homa Bay, Migori, Siaya and Nairobi. Due to the clear, present and imminent danger of breach of peace and public order, the government notifies the public that for the time being, we will not allow demonstrations within the central business districts of Nairobi, Mombasa, and Kisumu.
The move to bar protesters from holding demonstrations has angered opposition supporters across Kenya, who view the move as an infringement of their right to hold peaceful demonstrations. The move has also angered business people, who say that they will close indefinitely until things are back to normal. I spoke to Lucy Njeri, who was closing a shop in fear of vandalism and looting.
They are really affecting our business. As you can see, for now, we have already closed. We can't open because they will steal from us.
The World Bank had projected that Kenya's economy will grow by 5.9% this year. John Ngumi, an economist from the Kenya Private Sector Alliance, tells me that if the protests don't end, then they could negatively affect the country's economic growth.
If the demos are every day and they are still allowed into the CBD, they will close every day. Those are the impacts you're seeing. It's a post-August, which runs now into the end of the year, which has brought that extra level of uncertainty. We will be lucky if we hit 5. Yeah, it's tough. It's tough.
Ngumi adds that foreign investors have started withdrawing from Kenya due to the uncertainty surrounding the political climate.
I think your foreign portfolio investors will look more at the macro indicators. So if you've got a slowdown in economy, that almost certainly means a slowdown in government revenues and government expenditure. Translated, it means that the likelihood of a weaker exchange rate becomes more real. When you have that and you're a foreign investor who has invested in Nairobi Stock Exchange shares, and what tends to happen in that situation, which may be happening now, is that I'd rather sell my shares now and get my cash now before the anticipated devaluation comes on.
Andrew Wasike with that report from Nairobi.
A report that has sent Kenyans commenting so much on our social media platforms. It seems like there's lots of political talk in Kenya.
Of course,
in Liberia, in Spain, all over. Yeah. And we just got a comment coming in here from Tamafo Samuel from southern Cameroon. He says, this is not going to help the situation but worsen it. This is the beginning of the end of Kenyatta and his dictatorial ambitions.
Yes, and this one here from Nigeria, Rusadewe Ebiwoy, says demonstrations are not devoid of violence and the governments will not be sincere even if they are peaceful.
Interesting. He doesn't just stop there. He really sent in a long comment and we do try to read a bit of it. He goes on to say it shouldn't affect their strategy if they are serious about what they want. The quest for freedom or a political change always a face of oppositions. It's through this that we have to prove their point to the government.
Andy from Zimbabwe says justice should prevail.
Yes, so many of those comments, but we leave it at that. If time allows, we'll come back to it a little later. But then elsewhere in the world, it's a historic moment for Palestinians as rival factions Hamas and Fatah reach a deal in an agreement mediated by Egypt. In it, the two groups agree to hand over administrative control of Gaza to a unity government. Details of the agreement have yet to be announced, but both parties have said it is a major breakthrough. DW News David Sincock with a report on how Palestinians have received this news.
The deal between the rival Palestinian factions could bring relief to the blockaded Gaza Strip. The economy and humanitarian conditions have declined sharply since Hamas ousted Fatah from the territory a decade ago after winning parliamentary elections. Basic supplies are often lacking and electricity restricted to a few hours a day.
If I had a weapon, I would be shooting into the air out of happiness because they reached a deal.
I hope the Gaza siege will finish so there will be jobs and people will be able to support their families.
It's a similar story in the West Bank city of Ramallah. Cautious optimism that this latest deal marks a real breakthrough.
Our hope is to bring the country together. That is what every Palestinian wants.
We hope this time there will be unity. This is what the nation needs.
Exact details on the path forward are still some way off. Various Palestinian factions are expected to join talks on forming a wider unity government in the weeks ahead.
DW's David Sincock with the latest reactions from Palestine. And we go on. Now, Johannes Perus is a student of film production from the Film Academy in the German city of Baden-Württemberg. As a young man working in a small community radio in Ghana, he noticed something amiss in the area, so he thought to do something, and it was a film. Galamsey, which translates to illegal gold mining in Ghana, is the name of the film, and it depicts what happens there. Yesterday, the 37-year-old received the coveted Students' Oscars Award in Los Angeles. He told me what the award means to him.
I mean, the award is a great appreciation for the work I was doing so far. As a filmmaker, you work, you spend a lot of time in a dark room editing, and sometimes you doubt or you're not sure if what you're doing is if you're the only person that really likes what you're doing. And an award like this really tells you that you're on the right path, and it opens up opportunities.
You've done quite several films before. Why did you have to choose to focus on illegal gold mines this time around?
In 2010, I came to Twifoprasso, a small town in Ghana, and I saw how the town changed through this Galamsey, this illegal gold mining. It caught my attention, and when I, 5 years later, had the opportunity to shoot my own film, I thought this is the topic that I should go for, and I returned to that a small town, and I wanted to find out what this supposed blessing of gold really means for the people in this small town.
What exactly do you mean? How did the town change?
Well, whilst I was there, I saw that money was coming in, like fast money. They opened up new food spots, and even when you were in those spots, sometimes you saw like these huge strong man with gold chains and this attitude coming in, and everybody had to step out of their way and they were served first. And there was at the riverside, this is where they do this the illegal activities, they had like almost like their own area. It was like a kind of lawless territory. Teenage pregnancy rose during that time. Some of the farmers got into conflicts with the gold miners because of land issues. It was a topic that was visible in many areas of life in this town.
Winner of Student Oscars, Johannes Perus, with that very interesting story. It's amazing how you turn an observation into a film idea and actually do win an Oscar. Isn't it interesting?
That's creativity. So before we go back to our top story, we would like to thank those of you who are following us on our Facebook page, DW Africa. And our top story was about Kenya banning the protest. We asked how will this ban affect the strategy of the protesters. Caleb Chauro from Nairobi, Kenya, says banning demos from CBD is a good move, and I hope it's out of goodwill.
Interesting. Mixed comments coming in there. We also have another one coming from Daniel Wanyama, also from Nairobi, who says Kenya, who says the ban will affect protesters in the sense that they will not have any movement, bearing in mind that these are major cities that have been banned.
And Wilson Lukati John says it is a cowardly decision by the government, which is on the brink of collapse by uprising revolution on election reforms. Uhuru Kenyatta must go.
Interesting comments there. I'll read a quick one here from Wambui Machara, who says demonstrations must be banned because property has been looted and the right demonstrators do the wrong thing. Keep those comments coming and we'll certainly read them as time allows us to.
Welcome once again to the program. I am Zipporah Nyambura.
And I'm Jane Ayeko-Kumet. We are coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany. Still to come, from a war survivor to a victor.
How can you make peace tangible to people who have suffered injustice? And that's why we say heal people physical injuries, help them heal emotionally. It will open the space for historical dialogue.
An inspiring story there coming up shortly, but we will also hear about a Ghana's genius girl who has joined university at the age of 13 years.
But first we take you to Congo. The Democratic Republic of Congo Electoral Commission says the long-delayed election to replace President Joseph Kabila cannot take place until at least April 2019. It is the third time the polls are being postponed. They were originally scheduled for November 2016. The United Nations is warning that delays are creating a tense and uncertain political climate in the country. I talked to Phil Clark, an expert on DRC at Swaz University of London. And first, I wanted to find out what this postponement means for DRC.
This delay in the elections does look like just another attempt by Kabila to try to cling to power as long as he possibly can. This has been Kabila's tactic over the last 12 months to try to use logistical problems and a supposed delay in the electoral cycle to cling on to the presidency. The reality is the vast majority of Congolese don't believe this argument. And so this situation is going to cause a great deal of instability. Now.
Well, you just said it right, because the opposition has also said the delay is a ploy by Kabila to stay in power. But what options does the opposition have, if any?
The opposition in Congo is in a very difficult situation at the moment, in that they themselves are extremely divided. There have been various attempts over the last 12 months to try to build a more coherent opposition coalition, but we've seen that coalition start to break down in the last few months. And that's also been part of Kabila's tactic. He's also used new cabinet position and a range of other strategies to try to weaken the opposition. So all of this is really part of Kabila's plan, and he seems to be getting exactly what he wants at the moment.
So we know that dozens of people died last year in protest against Kabila's refusal to step down at the end of his term. Are we likely to see more violence?
There will almost certainly be new protests in the streets of major towns and cities across Congo after this latest delay to the election. The population has shown over the last 12 months that they don't believe Kabila. They think that he's trying to cling to power. There's an enormous amount of anger. So I think we're going to see the protests continue. And every time there have been large-scale protests in the last 12 months, there has also been a very violent crackdown, particularly by the Congolese police. That is the pattern that I think we're going to see over the next 6 to 12 months, is the opposition trying to mobilize these continued protests. We're going to see violent crackdowns. And I think the fear of many Congolese people is that this will also lead to a very significant civilian death toll. So it's very volatile days ahead for Congo.
Now, Congo's Electoral Commission says it needs at least 500 days to organize the polls once the voter registration is done. Why do you think they need so much time?
It's undoubtedly true that in Congo, organizing elections is extremely complicated. It's a vast country with very limited infrastructure. The last two presidential elections in Congo have been very, very complicated to organize. So the Electoral Commission is undoubtedly telling the truth when they say that they need a huge amount of time to do this. But the bigger question is, why are they only beginning the organization of the elections now? The preparations for this vote really should have happened 2 years ago. So again, this is part of a deliberate stalling tactic for the Electoral Commission to say, look, you know, we need another year and a half, sort of ignores the fact that these preparations really should have begun a long time ago. So this is all part of the same deliberate delay tactic.
I was talking to Dr. Phil Clark, an expert on DRC at Swaz University of London.
You know, Nyambura, it's very, very interesting what is happening in the DRC. I mean, you and me have been following the developments, the political developments there, especially regarding elections, the first postponement, the second postponement, and so on. And today's announcement is also not coming in as a surprise. But what I find interesting is that the elections have been postponed to 2019, and the Electoral Commission actually says that they need more than 500 days to prepare.
Right.
And these 500 days, basically after the voter register has been updated, then they need another 500 days. That's basically more, almost 2 years.
That's
time
5 years for the elections.
To prepare for this election. Now, we put this question to our listeners, to our followers on the different social media platforms, and we did ask them how independent the Electoral Commission in their country was.
Yeah, and I think the comments are very interesting. I'll start with the first one here from Kanjo Etienne, who says, in Cameroon, the members of the Electoral Commission are all former members of government appointed by the president. Cameroon's Electoral Commission works for the interests of the president in power and has never conducted transparent elections.
That's a strong one. They are never conducted strong elections. But it's also interesting to see how really our listeners are following trends throughout the whole continent. There's just interest beyond your own environment. I mean, there's this comment coming in from Ghana here, from Tega King from Ghana. He says, in most African countries, especially the French-speaking countries, the president has a hold on everything. Influential or important persons who emerge from the political scene, social or economic sectors pay allegiance directly to the president because he buys them off through institutionalized corruption.
Kimi Sangwe, also from Cameroon, buys into that and says the Electoral Commission in almost all the countries in Africa, including mine, is controlled by the president.
Well, I still have to read this one because it's coming in from Congo itself. Somebody says, in my country, DRC, this is what is killing it. It's dictatorship, it's corruption, and we the youth will not accept this kind of what he calls nonsense from the blood-sucking demons. Kabila's time is out, just like it is in the Congo.
On.
Now, 13-year-old girl Ruth Gayan Dakwa is making headlines in Ghana. She has become the youngest student to be admitted in a university in that country. And as our DW correspondent in Ghana, Isaac Alechi, found out she is ready for the new challenge in the university.
I am in Kumasi to meet Dakwa, who has just been admitted to one of Ghana's most prestigious universities, the Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology. In case you are wondering how she made it to university at 13, Dakwa was way ahead of most students and had to skip some classes. She went for only 2 terms at the kindergarten, skipped class 6, and skipped 2 stages at the junior high school level. At the university, she will be studying mathematics. She tells me her success is due to extra support she received from her teachers at home.
Especially in the evening around 6:30, we get teachers to help us. So what we learn in school and we don't get it, then they will be teaching us.
Dakwa has just started class and doesn't seem to be intimidated by her elderly colleagues.
I want to become a lecturer in mathematics, and after that, after the first year, the first degree, I go outside and learn space engineering or space science.
Dakwa's father, Jan Dakwa, is also behind her success, a maths teacher at the senior high school level. So does this run in the family?
The first 4 girls, they are very intelligent. First one, very, very intelligent girl. She completed DSS at 11. And then the second one, she is Josephine Jandakwa. The first one is Grace. She could have gone to university around 12 or 11. And then Ruth. Ruth is equally intelligent. Very, very good.
Jandakwa says her daughter's success has not come by chance.
When they are toddlers, the mother will teach them up to a certain stage. They will graduate from the school and they will come to mine. So they have intensive home education. They don't joke with that.
Ruth's mother, Delight Jandakwa, couldn't hide her joy at the success of her daughter.
In the beginning, I aided her with her writings. When she got better at that, then I introduced her to other things. Because of that, she doesn't accept anything else taught to her by an outsider. She trusts what I teach her.
Dakwe's story doesn't only inspire other students, but her siblings, like Josephine Dakwa, who are hoping to follow in her footsteps.
It's unbelievable. That's it. This is just the beginning. If she learns hard and she gets good grades and her performance is very good, she'll be greater than she is now.
Isaac Kalechi with that report about Ghana's latest genius girl in mathematics.
Speaking out.
12 years ago, the Lord's Resistance Army retreated from northern Uganda, leaving behind a devastated community. Civilians were caught in the midst of a deadly conflict between the LRA and government troops. Millions suffered in the ensuing violence. Although the fighting has since ended, many physical and psychological wounds remain untreated.
Now, Ugandan peace activist Victor Ochieng, who himself grew up in the midst of the conflict, is doing something. Through his organization, African Youth Initiative Network, he facilitates provision of medical and psychological support for victims. Stephen Moll prepared this report, now presented by Wanjiku Mwaura.
We are at St. Joseph Hospital in Kitgum, northern Uganda. Here, some 200 patients are receiving treatment, having sustained wounds during the Lord's Resistance Army insurgency. Many of them are here courtesy of the African Youth Initiative Network. The founder, Victor Ochieng, believes that if people are given a chance to heal, this new peace can last. As Ochieng explains, many of the victims, like James Omara, have never seen a doctor.
Omara James was abducted from Abia and he spent about 7 months in captivity. So while he was in captivity, he would be made to walk long distance. But then as a process of torture, the rebel kept on piercing his leg with the bayonet.
Like the millions who suffered LRA atrocities, James Omara feels forgiveness is a long process.
I have no problem with forgiving those who injured me, as long as I am healed. But this is subject to my ability to get back, to heal, and to become normal again. That defines whether I can or cannot forgive.
With the treatment he's getting now, it's very likely that Omara will walk again. But Ochieng's project that helps many such people needs financial support. So he uses such success stories as Omara's to seek help. He himself grew up in the midst of the violence and later worked as a journalist and reported from the conflict zone. 10 years ago, Victor quit his radio job to fully commit to his organization. Many victims have not gotten over their experiences, and that is why Ochieng believes physiological therapy is important.
How can you make peace tangible to people who have suffered injustice? And that's why we say heal people physical injuries, help them heal emotionally. It will open the space for historical dialogue, a difficult dialogue, the dialogue that might be going through layers and unveiling many untold painful stories.
Beneficiaries of Ochieng's organization are all happy to get home and till the fields again without pain. Betty Atim is one of them. She had sustained a bullet shot on her ankle and the wound had become septic.
When I came back from hospital, the biggest change in my life was that I felt accepted again in the community. Previously, I was alone. I would walk in public and everyone would walk away from me. I could smell myself. Everybody turned away. I was stigmatized and not accepted, not even in the church or in the market, nowhere. I smelled so badly.
And so Ochieng wishes for more practice issues than mere paperwork.
Let us try to make peace a reality, not only papers. We can sign treaties, we can sign constitution and put in the cupboard. If it does not transform life, that is not peace to us.
In 2015, he was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Since then, he has turned down prestigious job offers abroad because he knows that Uganda's wounds are still a long way from being healed.
A report by Stephen Moll, and that's all we had time for. Thank you for joining us. From me, Jane Ayeka Kumet.
And me, Zipporah Nyambura. It's bye for now.